This Week in Retronauts, someone finally puts this Nintendo versus Sega debate to the rest. Hi everyone, welcome to another live Retronauts panel. I am Jeremy Parrish, your stentor, your lector, your didact for this presentation, and I'm here with two of the finest fellow Retronauts the Earth could possibly hope for. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Nadia Oxford. Apparently I'm a really fine Retronaut. It's a pleasure to be here. I am also with Axe of the Blood God, which is an RPG podcast. We talk about RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western.
And down there at the end.
Hello, my name is Diamond Fight, and I'm sure I had a joke, but Jeremy lost me with those words. What were you, didact?
Didact? I don't know. I'm being didactic.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm
just happy to be here.
I just whipped out my brain thesaurus and anything to fill some time. If you have been to my, that's right.
Oh, yes.
Exactly.
Let's applaud for didact.
Oh.
There we go.
Oh, you're applauding for us and not for filling time. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, so this presentation is called Sega versus Nintendo, Toy Maker versus Game Maker, which is kind of, a little bit misleading, but it's an exploration of the differences between Sega and Nintendo. So before we get started, I have to ask, who out here considers yourself more of a Sega fan than a Nintendo fan? Go ahead and applaud. Let's hear it. Let's hear the votes. Okay, the guys
are
Sega shirts, yeah. All right, I guess that was a given. And who considers themselves more a Nintendo fan than Sega fan? Ooh, a little uneven there. Nadia, where do you fall on
this? I am Nintendo. Like, you don't even understand how obnoxious I was when I was a kid.
No, I have an idea.
Okay.
My God.
Well, no, I just...
Sorry about that.
No, that's pretty funny. No, I was very much I evangelized Nintendo. Like, I was actually one of those really annoying kids who I'd be playing my friend's Sega and be making fun of it the whole time until they told me to shut up. So that's where I sit.
And Diamond?
Well, I dabbled in both, but I certainly had more Nintendo stuff. But I would say in recent years, I've been embracing the oddities, shall we say, of the Sega catalog and the Sega sort of spirit. And I think watching Uncle from Another World helped me embrace sort of the Sega mindset. And I keep eyeing the shirt that says, like, do you think a Sega fan would live a life this well? And, like, I it's all in Japanese. And I keep eyeballing, like, geez, do I want that? I'm not a Sega person per se, but I like Sega.
You can't wear the lie. It's too much of a lie.
It's a nice Sega hoodie, though, covered in hardware. It's very nice.
So let me put this to the audience. Who of you is morally on the right side of history and appreciates both companies for their excellence across the spectrum? That's right. It's a false paradigm. They tried to sell us on a rivalry, but as history has taught us, both of these companies made some really damn good games. They still make some really damn good games. This panel is not about whose games are better. It's about why did the games that they make feel so different from one another? Why did Nintendo games not ever feel like a Sega game? And why did anything that Sega made, like, you'd never think, oh, this might be a Nintendo game. Like, you knew when you played these games. And it wasn't just because you knew what the capabilities of the NES versus the Master System were, or what the Genesis sounded like versus the Super Nintendo. There was a fundamental difference of design philosophy behind Nintendo and Sega games. And my theory, my premise, thesis, I guess is what we're saying, for this panel is that it comes down to their origins and what both companies were fundamentally about. Nintendo was fundamentally a toy maker, and Sega was fundamentally a company about making games. And to really understand this, you need to look back into the early days of their history. Nintendo, of course, started out making games, making card games, cards for card games. And they did that for a very long time until the 1960s or so, when the cards industry kind of collapsed on them. They teamed up with Disney back in, this is just some footage of Nintendo stuff at their unofficial museum in Kyoto. It looks terrible because it's on VHS tape, which is what people would have filmed Nintendo stuff on back in the 80s and 90s, which is what we're talking about. But they teamed up with Disney and published Disney character playing cards, and the bottom fell out of that market in the 1960s and left them with a very low value stock and basically asking, what are we going to do to survive? And so company president Hiroshi Yamauchi, who was not afraid to make hard decisions, even if they were like super cutthroat to his own family, said, let's do other things. So Nintendo started making other things. That includes instant noodles. That includes supposedly running love hotels. I think that might be a little exaggerated, but the point is, they really kind of flailed around for a while until they seized upon making toys. And that was really courtesy of someone they had working in their warehouse, an engineer named Gunpei Yokoi, who was great at just coming up with cool ideas for fun things. You know, toys that, you know, they weren't like toys that we saw in the 80s where you had storylines for your G.I. Joes and your Cobras. It was just things that, you know, you gave to a kid and just let the kid's imagination run wild, run free. Things like the
Ultra Hand?
Yes, the Ultra Hand was the first big invention. You want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, the Ultra Hand was, if I recall, it was one of those things where you squeeze it and it goes, and like, you know, pinches. I think it was like kind of marketed almost as like a robot hand. And if I'm not mistaken, this might not be the same instance, but there, I think Yamauchi saw Gunpei Yokoi working on that toy or something like it. And instead of berating him and saying, go back to work, that's not what you were hired for, Yamauchi said, that's a good idea. If you're good at this, you should absolutely make this and we will absolutely sell it. And that's one thing I have to say about Yamauchi is he knew he was not a creative. He knew he was like the opposite of a toy maker. He was like the villain in a story about like toys being taken away from children. He just has that personality. And he knew it. So he said, I'm going to hire the best creative people. If I see someone doing something cool, I'm going to encourage them. And I think that might have been a big reason why Nintendo has that real almost like childlike wonder to it. It was really encouraged at the time.
Yeah, Nintendo began in the 60s and throughout the 70s making toys that were just, you know, basically tools for kids to use creatively, like the Ultra Hand, where they could grab things off a shelf or, you know, pinch someone's bottom, you know, whatever, the unchi, what is it they like to do over there? If you're
Concho?
Oh, Concho, that's it.
Oh my goodness. I don't think the Ultra Hand would work for that, but I guess you could try it.
You could put like a little pokey finger fist in there, and you get the Ultra Hand Concho.
You should probably get arrested if you do that.
If you wire it up with some hydraulics, yeah. Just knock someone in the next room with it.
They're going to send us to the hospital.
So anyway, yes, kind of a DIY enema. They also created a device that it looks like a camera, but it's actually a video audio microphone. It uses light beams to transmit audio. It's just, they came up with all kinds of cool, innovative ideas to use inexpensive technology and just let kids run wild, light guns and things like that. Sega was not that company. Sega was started, depending on where you want to begin, put the pin in the chronology, either in the 1940s as a distribution company to bring jukeboxes and pinball games and things like that to servicemen working overseas during World War II, stationed overseas, or, you know, if you want to kind of look ahead to when the company actually became Sega by name, that was in the 60s, but it was still the same thing. It was a vending company. It was a company that, you know, made pinball machines, jukeboxes. Well, initially they distributed them, and eventually they said, oh, we should just make our own. So they did. Pachinko machines, all throughout the 60s and 70s, that was what Sega was doing. And both of these companies, their businesses kind of eventually led them to making video games from different directions. With Nintendo, it was, again, that flailing around desperation. They saw an opportunity to use, it was abandoned bowling alleys, because there was a bowling craze, and like so many fads in Japan, it lasted for about 2 years and then it was gone. So all of a sudden there were these abandoned bowling alleys, so they said, why not create shooting ranges with light guns? And that became, you know, the fundamental basis of not only the Duck Hunt light gun toy that kids could play at home with little projections, but also with arcade projection games, installation-based devices like Wild Gunman. And so, you know, these you might know these names because they became NES games 10, 15, 20 years later. But they started as toys and as, you know, location-based amusements. And that's sort of how Nintendo became a toy maker, or a video game maker. Whereas Sega, they made pinball games, they made electromechanical devices, you know, they had an electromechanical game called Duck Hunt in the 1960s. So, you know, they're kind of on the same wavelength there, but working in a different medium. And eventually, pinball and electromechanical games lead you to making Pong clones, and Pong clones eventually lead you to making your own inventive brand new video games, like The Fonz, based on Happy Days character Fonzie, what's his name?
Fonzarella.
Fonzarella, that's right. Driving a motorcycle. You know, games like that. And that sort of established Sega's business, their core business, ultimately, as arcade games.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. Saturday, what a day. Ruin all week with you. These days are awesome. Happy days. These days are
So when both of these companies began to make home video games, consoles, in 1983 or so, that led them to creating very different kinds of home games. I don't know if either of you wants to add anything here.
I just had to say, this is a weird factoid. I don't know when else I'm going to say it. So I've been watching James Bond films lately, again, because I've seen them all again. And I was stunned to learn that if you watch Casino Royale, not the good one, the ridiculous 1967 movie directed by like five people, if you watch that movie, They of course, it's a casino, right? Casino Royale. You can see Ursula Andress using a Sega slot machine. And the Sega branding is clearly visible on camera. So just a little hint, like, hey, in the 60s, that's what Sega did. Sega did what Nintendo didn't.
I just want to add, I don't know, again, this is another fact, I don't know where I'm going to add it, but yes, Nintendo did a lot of other stuff, like they really branched out. They also did a line of strollers that had to be recalled because they kept pinching kids.
Yeah, they also made Lego knockoffs called InBlock.
You can see those in Mario Land too, if they're in the background of some of the stages.
Yeah. So they were all over the place, but they really, like, they had a lot of success with toys just in general. And this right here on the screen is the device I was talking about earlier. That looks like a camcorder that you'd see, you know, in the 70s or 80s, but that is actually a device that transmits audio through light. It's wild. I don't know how it works, but it does somehow. They figured all this out. So anyway, Sega, I think, made really, really amazing arcade games. Like, this is Afterburner, there's, you know, Hang On. These games are amazing. They're just like pure visceral joy to play. Even now, there's an Afterburner out there on the show floor. Go play it, and you know it's hard and unfair, but just the spectacle and the feel of like things flying at you in your face is still incredible 30 years later. Nintendo, you know, they had some good arcade games, no doubt. I mean, Donkey Kong, an all-time classic. Popeye, really good. Punch-Out was amazing. But the thing about Nintendo is they didn't really pursue technology. They didn't really make most of those games themselves. They kind of designed them, and then, you know, the programming and manufacturing was often handled by other companies. And once the Nintendo Family Computer, the precursor to the NES, came out in 1983, Nintendo kind of stopped making arcade games. They said, you know what, toys, home games, like consumer products, that's really our business. And they focused all their game resources, game development resources, on the home market. After the Famicom came out, you had Mario Brothers launch a couple of months later. I think Donkey Kong 3 might have come out after the Famicom. And then you had Punch-Out. And Punch-Out, like, amazing.
It's
wow,
still amazing.
That game, that, like, I don't know if you remember Punch-Out or arm wrestling from the 80s, if you were old enough to have seen those, but it was just like, how is this a video game? It was like, you know, Laserdisc animation quality, but without the Laserdisc stuff. It was actually interactive instead of pretending.
I just want to interject with a question. I had heard, and I don't know if this is the same thing, is it true that the arm wrestling machines Nintendo made broke someone's arm, or they could break arms, or is that something else that someone made?
I don't know, but I know the Love Tester machine they make could break hearts.
Aww.
Now, Nadia, I think you're thinking of the arm wrestling minigame in Fatal Fury, because that, if you make it to the end of that game, the highest difficulty arm wrestler will just snap you in two.
Oh,
he's,
no.
He's a brutal monster.
So arm wrestling and Punch-Out came out around the same time that Sega started to make these super scalar games like we just looked at. But the thing is, like, Punch-Out, by all accounts, was actually just made because they had a ton of monitors left over. And so they were like, let's come up with a game idea where you have to have two monitors in a single cabinet. It was just like clearing out some inventory. And then, you know, when that didn't work, they also created the PlayChoice 10. Clear out more of those extra monitors with double screens.
Why'd they buy so many? What were they doing? Were they okay?
I don't know. I think they're like people nowadays, you know, like I hoard CRTs because they keep getting more expensive and they look so good when you play classic games on them.
I have to wonder, what
they were
what
ahead
do you
of
think,
the curve.
What do you think the percentage like of total video game, like all video games that are made, what percentage of those games only exist because the parent company or publisher had an excess amount of inventory? Like, we need to do this. We need to do this. Like, so many Capcom games existed because they had extra boards or they wanted to reuse something. You know, Nintendo infamously reused everything. You know, it just...
That's where Donkey Kong came from. I mean, that's the famous story right
the
there.
The radar scope.
They estimated America's demand for a Space Invaders clone years after the Space Invader never actually happened in America. The Space Invaders boom never happened in America, so they had to come up with another game for it. And there's Donkey Kong, and oops, all of a sudden, Nintendo's like, video games is our thing. We're good at this.
Also, I want to point out that you can still see Nintendo characters in arcade games to this day, but they're always exclusively in other... They're made by other companies.
Yeah.
Like Namco Bandai, which they worked together many times. I think Capcom has also published a few of them. So it's like, you can still see Nintendo characters in Japanese arcades, but it's usually like a metal game, which is like gambling, but it's not gambling because you just win worthless tokens, or just sort of like the Mario Kart racing game, which is just, you know, full of Nintendo characters, and I think Pac-Man is in there too, and it's just, you know, it looks great. It looks just like Mario Kart, but it's also not made by Nintendo.
Didn't Sega work on a Mario or an F-Zero game? Okay, well, there you go. See, told you. They're pals.
They've always been friends.
Yeah, I think Critical Kate recently tweeted a picture of a Sega-made sheriff cabinet.
Oh, nice.
Oh, nice.
That was a good find.
Oh, yeah, you had a head-on and head-on in. Anyway, the point is, Nintendo pretty much gave up on making cool, cutting-edge arcade games. Meanwhile, Sega was like, we love 3D arcade games. Let's create the coolest arcade technology for making 3D games. And so Yu Suzuki, who loved racing and math, sat down and said, I'm going to make arcade hardware that lets me use my math powers so I can pretend to race and have an excuse to go out to Europe and drive sports cars around as research. And so we came up with OutRun. And what was that we just saw? Enduro Racer and Hang On and so on and so forth. Sega was just always at the cutting edge of technology. My feeling, especially as I've spent more time digging into Sega's history, is that Sega didn't necessarily see Nintendo as the competition. They saw Namco as the competition. Mm. Namco was out there doing really cool stuff like Thunder Cross that was really just kind of butting up into the same territory as Sega's Superscalar games and things like this. Oh, there you go, Galaxy Force. Like, they just kept doing amazing stuff. It's maybe not so great to look at on the screen like this, but
in the day, kids,
when you're playing and not just looking at a projection of a VHS capture, it's really awesome.
I think it's pretty awesome, to be honest. Yes. I'm watching capture. I like it.
So Sega was really more in competition with Namco. And on the home market, you know, they launched their home console, SG-1000, the same day that Nintendo launched the family computer in Japan, and the family computer just absolutely eclipsed the SG-1000 in terms of sales, but Sega didn't have any big expectations for the SG-1000. So when it sold, you know, hundreds of thousands of units, they were like, wow, this is a pretty good way to supplement our arcade income. And so they just kept making consoles for another 20 years almost, and some of those consoles are really, really great. I guess all of them are.
They're,
I don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe not Pico.
Poor Pico.
Do we count Pico? I don't think we count Pico.
One Pico fan stood up amongst all of us.
You are
someone
the Pico.
Stand up for Pico.
Again, heroes. Heroes, all of you.
So, what does it mean, toy maker versus game maker? What it means is that Nintendo makes games that feel like toys, and Sega makes games that feel like arcade experiences that want your money and all of it as often as possible. And so, you have the arcade-style games that come from Sega, and even when you have modern Sega games like Yakuza, you still have the opportunity to go to arcades and play Hang-On.
Hell yeah.
It's not just like them kind of patting themselves on their back and saying, yeah, we made Hang-On. It's also them saying, like, hey, this is, you know, kind of our core ethos here, these really cool, exciting games. I mean, you look at Yakuza, and those games are kind of an open world, you know, crime simulation, whatever, but you're always getting into fights. Just
hell yeah.
Over and over again, because it's Sega, and there's got to be the action. That's like the core kernel of the experience. Shenmue began as a Virtua Fighter RPG.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
What if we put RPG elements into, you know, Virtua Fighter, but, you know, you're still, it's Virtua Fighter, so you're still fighting things and beating people up. Nintendo, they stray off into the weeds sometimes, and they give you stuff like Animal Crossing. That would never come from Sega.
That would be amazing. Can you imagine an Animal Crossing with Sonic characters? I would play that.
Don't make me. I mean, Mabel's in there. She's so and
she's so
for you.
She's
so
such
fast.
A, yeah.
She's almost like Sonic.
Too fast. Cool.
So, obviously, things are less distinct between Sega and Nintendo now because Sega no longer makes hardware. But, you know, this is Retro World Expo, so we're talking about old games, classic games.
Yeah.
We're really focusing on the 80s and 90s stuff. What does it mean to create a toy-like experience in a game? I'd like to hear the panelists answer this before I give my...
Should I go first? Or
yes. I don't know. Diamond, why don't you go first?
Yeah.
Let's mix things up.
Well, my first thought is the notorious Rob, Robot Buddy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was in one sense a transparent attempt to convince people, oh no, we aren't trying to bring back video games. Video games did badly. This is a toy. This is an entertainment system. That's why they redesigned it to look like a VCR. Like they made lots of changes to make it appeal to the marketers and the toy buyers. But ultimately, Rob and the Rob games are very much, you know, it's almost like a diorama kind of thing where you're controlling a little guy and you're moving things up and down as you literally move things around in your living room. And then there's the other one that I forgot the name of. What's the other one, Jeremy?
The other
not
Rob
Mike.
Game? Stack Up.
Stack Up.
It's not actually a game, so it's okay to forget about it.
Right. it's still very clearly...
It's basically just a thing for collectors to spend a lot of money on.
Yeah.
And right. Not actually want to play.
Nintendo saw that coming.
Mm.
But you look at that thing and, you know, Rob, or AKA, in Japan, just called Robot. It does exist in Japan where they didn't need the robot, but they still made it there anyway, and so people still know what it is, and they even made it with a Famicom color, so I guess you could probably collect that if you're really, really diehard and you want to find one. But I just think that's a fun little ambassador to the sort of toy... I hate this word, but also it's more appropriate, like the toyetic feel that I think Nintendo games of that era kind of had. The fact they actually literally packaged the system with a toy to help get their foot in the door, and then once they realized they didn't need it, they just had they had good enough games already. It's like, okay, well, so long, Rob. We'll bring you back in Smash Brothers.
Well, he's kind of there was Rob 64 as well in Star Fox 64.
Yeah, and Rob shows up in Mario Kart DS and so forth.
Oh, he does.
He's out there. He's
a quiet
around. Yeah.
He's a quiet ambassador now.
Yep.
He's retired.
He doesn't have the Luigi death stare. He's just got a blank expression. Nadia, what do you think it means to have a toy-like design, game design?
I think the best way to describe it is when I was younger, you know, I had the Nintendo. I just said I was a big Nintendo kid. And my brother really wanted a Genesis because he thought my games were slow and lame. And you think of the way the games that were packed back then, like Sega Genesis, the first packing game was the Altered Beast, and that it was an arcade adaptation, whereas Nintendo's launch game was Super Mario World, which is, you said earlier, Nintendo had a tendency to give kids toys and say, okay, figure this out for yourself. That's very much the nature of Super Mario World, because that is a game where you are wandering and you are exploring and you are finding things. And when I was, as I said, that obnoxious Nintendo fan, I used to say, like, look, Nintendo's games, they're slow, they're methodical, they're fun, they let me kind of stop and think. I don't want to, like, you know, go, not to say I hated Sonic or anything like that, but it's just like, oh boy, I'm blazing really fast through these levels that I just don't have any, you know, reason to explore. And I liked those games. I liked how arcade-like they were, but growing up, you know, even growing up, I was a huge RPG fan, and I liked those slower, more methodical, more storytelling, those games that tended to tell me a story. Like, those are the ones I loved. And Nintendo was just, you know, the one who gave it to me, whereas Sega was like, okay, if you want to play a pretty decent adaptation of, you know, Altered Beast or, you know, Outrun, here you are. But these games are going to last you maybe, you know, an hour or so, and you're going to get bored with them.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what I had in mind here when I say toy-like game experience. The idea that Nintendo games have a tendency to just give you a space to play in. I mean, they have structure. Mario has, you know, levels you have to complete, and there's a flag at the end. But, you know, compared to other arcade games of the era, where you were going from left to right as fast as possible, trying to, you know, just avoid dying, Mario, Super Mario Brothers, and its sequels were really about, you know, you could do that, but then it provoked your curiosity. You could do things like break bricks, and so it's, you know, you might start thinking, like, what happens if I break the bricks at the top of the screen and then try to jump up above the screen? And it turns out you can do that, and not only can you do that, but if you do it in the right place, you can jump across a gap and go to a warp zone that takes you to new levels as a shortcut. And Nintendo games, I think there's a real sense of just letting people fool around to a certain degree and discover things on their own, and they really delight in giving you that sense of discovery and rewarding it.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think is very, very fundamental to Nintendo's design philosophy. And I know I've told this story before on the podcast, but maybe, like, I guess it was more than 10 years ago when Nintendo was showing off new Super Mario Brothers Wii at E3, I went to a press conference, like a small press conference, where the game development team was showing off the game, you know, in advance of its launch, and Shigeru Miyamoto was there. And while they were getting everyone was coming in the room and getting set up, he was just, like, totally ignoring the room and absorbed by playing the game. He was playing an ice level, and he was basically just farting around, like, trying to see what he could do with the penguin suits, and, you know, I don't remember what all was there, like ice balls or something. And, you know, he didn't like play to complete the level. He did what I see a lot of people do, you know, the first time they play Mario or try to get their heads around it, which is just kind of like mess around in that first screen or two and just see what all you can do. And watching him just kind of goof around without any real objective to it made me, like, really, I feel like that was where it really clicked for me. Like, this is how Nintendo approaches game design. Sega, on the other hand, had a totally different approach. I mean, they've had games like that, sure. You know, you look at Alex Kidd, and there's all kinds of hidden stuff in there, and it's very much kind of channeling that 1980s microcomputer game design.
Yeah.
Where things are hidden, and it's sometimes kind of unfair, but you have to figure it out.
Also, B is jump.
they were still figuring out things back then. I'm not going to hold that against them. You can remap that in emulation, so it's
That's
all
true.
But, you know, going back through, over the past few years, I've been playing SG-1000 games and Master System games, and playing these older games by Sega, I realized, like, the arcade mentality was fundamental to Sega's game design ethos, even at home. Like, they thought about things in terms of arcade design, and when they're, you know, they had a separate division for making console games, but they still approached it that way. And you had a lot of crossover. You had, you know, Yuji Naka. I guess he didn't really work on many arcade games, but Yu Suzuki, you know, when he worked on console games, like, he still kind of brought that arcade mentality in there. And so Sega games, you know, especially in the 8-bit era, tended to be really, really difficult. Nintendo games could sometimes be difficult. There's, you know, the meme Nintendo hard, but I feel like that's misplaced. I feel like Sega was the company that really put out the games that were just like, you get 3 lives, you don't get to take any hits, that's it. How far can you make it? There's 20 stages here, but you're not going to get past stage two.
Yeah, I think you're right about it. I think that was one of the reasons I was usually pretty frustrated with Sega's games versus Nintendo games, because I was not a very good reflex gamer. I'm still not, but especially as a little kid, so that's why I preferred those slower games that let me kind of, you know, goof around. And you were talking about, you know, goofing around in the first couple of screens or so. Thinking about it, it's like in Mario 1-1, you also have the invisible 1-up, and something like that really kind of telegraphs to the player, hey, you're gonna, there's a lot of things here that you can't see, but it's worth it to stop and explore and take a look around. And I think that's, again, Nintendo's mentality right there.
Yeah, so I'm showing right now footage of the Master System version of Action Fighter, which was an arcade game where you had like a motorcycle that could transform into an airship and stuff like that.
Sweet.
And when they brought it to Master System, they pretty much, you know, carried forward the premise, but redesigned the game to make it more interesting and more fun, and also more streamlined. They really kind of stripped it down to like the essence of basically you're James Bond in a cool car that's sometimes a motorcycle and sometimes a jet, and that's, you know, kind of the real focus for that. And it works really, really well. It's like the arcade game is okay, but the home game is great. And, you know, when you have that pipeline going for Sega where they take a good idea in the arcades and then reprocess it and create something that works on the home system but still maintains that difficulty level and that sheer sense of, like, you know, this is hard, this is high energy, this is, you know, like very, very adrenaline pumping. That's Sega at their best. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that Nintendo platforms became known up until the PlayStation era as the place you went to play role-playing games.
Yeah, sure.
On consoles. Because RPGs fundamentally, you know, especially the older computer games, like, you know, I just put together a video about Ultima Exodus for NES. And that's the very essence of a game that just drops you into it and says, there's a lot going on here, a lot of systems, you figure it out. And it's a little unfriendlier than Nintendo's own games tended to be. But, you know, I do feel like the core essence of role-playing games, of exploring and, you know, learning and piecing together clues and, you know, finding treasures and becoming stronger and just getting better by investing time, but without a lot of punishment, is very fundamental to, like, the Nintendo design. Whereas Sega, like, they made some great RPGs, no question. Phantasy Star,
yeah.
Skies of Arcadia, love those games. But fundamentally, that was kind of contrary to Sega's approach, which was you're going to spend a lot of time with these games, but not, you know, not kind of feeling out the environment and going on a big adventure. You're going to spend a lot of time with these games playing the same few levels over and over again until you are a machine, until your reflexes and skills and memorization for these three or four stages has been honed to razor-sharp perfection, and you can basically do, you know, all games, what is it called? ADQ? Awesome games done quickly. That's it.
Oh, games
done
quickly. Yes. Yeah.
Like it was basically like the you know, the crucible for ADQ players. There 30 years before there was an ADQ.
I've been thinking about Zaxxon for the last 10 minutes.
As one should.
Yeah,
one should take at least 10 minutes out of each day to think about Zaxxon.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's like...
There's some Zaxxon footage in here. There we go.
It's, yeah, like a prayer at sometimes. But yeah, I've been thinking about that and thinking about what you said and how I remember, the, you know, seeing that game as a child and how usually the cabinet had an entire sort of flight yoke.
Mm-hmm.
So it really... And the way that the game controlled, it really emphasized, no, you push forward and go down, and you pull back, and you go up. And I don't think a lot of games necessarily reinforce that at the time, but I think as time went on, more games sort of lean into that.
Hmm.
So that, but in playing that game, I sort of had to learn that and get used to it and learn how to control my ship and understand where my ship was in relation to everything around it. And it's weird, because the game doesn't really tell a story, but it does have enough things in it that it sort of drew me in. Like, the eponymous Zaxxon is basically like the boss, but you can't kill the boss. You can kill his projectile. And it's just like, I remember we eventually had a Zaxxon board game. A lot of early arcade games.
Yeah.
A lot of early arcade games would have board games. Like Pac-Man had a board game.
We had the Pac-Man board game.
I'm pretty sure Donkey Kong had a board game.
We did.
But the Zaxxon board game to me was probably the most exciting one because the pieces, not only did the pieces move up and down, so you had to control your height level that way,
also
it came with a like little Zaxxon toy. I mean, it wasn't very big, but it was, like, compared to the ships, it was much bigger. And that to me was the most fun, like more than the board game itself, I just loved playing with the Zaxxon toy.
Did the Zaxxon robot have a spring-loaded missile?
It had like a missile in it, but I don't think it moved. I think it was a single unit.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, I think this was a time when it would have been frowned upon to have a toy fire a missile, I think, because...
No, this was, you know, back in the days of...
lawn darts.
Yeah, this was like 82, 83, so... There were no safety rules for kids yet. It was the Wild West for toys.
Every kid's eye was still intact for a moment.
Those of us who wore glasses had an advantage.
We really
do. So Zaxxon, I'm glad you mentioned because I did want to include it here. It's an interesting case study between Nintendo and Sega because this game was developed and programmed by the same company behind Donkey Kong, Ikegami Tsushinki. So Nintendo did a lot of subcontracting to programmers, and like Ikegami put together the boards for Donkey Kong, and then Donkey Kong. Well, I think Nintendo actually kind of like took their Donkey Kong Jr. or Donkey Kong boards and reworked themselves to create Donkey Kong Jr. But they had a falling out because Ikegami said, "Hey, we created this code, we own it," and Nintendo said, "No, we commissioned it and we gave you the game design, we own it." And there was a lot of debate over that. Ikegami stopped working with Nintendo and started working with Sega, and the people who made this game, when Sega worked with them, said, let's do this instead. And there's also a version of this, Zaxxon, called Congo Bongo, which is Donkey Kong, but from this perspective. But this game is, like, to me, this is kind of, like, fundamental Sega right here. Like, maybe that's just because I remember being awed by it when I saw it in 1982, and I was, like, this tall and could barely reach the controls and didn't understand why I was going down when I pressed up. It was very confusing. But it is fundamentally Sega. It is a cool game. Like, this was visually ahead of anything else in arcades at the time. Just amazing to look at. But also extremely challenging, but also once you spend some time getting your head around the inverted controls and the fact that you have to blow up fuel tanks so that your fuel gauge doesn't plummet to zero, and the fact that there's stuff from off-screen flying in at you that you have to avoid or shoot, like, it's really fun and really good. And I spent a lot of time with this game on ColecoVision and got really good at it, which, you know, skills no longer exist in my
brain. I actually I'm very jealous that I did not get to play it on the ColecoVision because I actually had a ColecoVision and I liked Zaxxon, but I had it on the Commodore 64 and it was on a monochrome screen with no sound. So I would have liked to, apparently, like, I saw your thing about it. It was a good game, wasn't it? A good adaptation for the ColecoVision.
Yeah. No, it was very good. It was on par with Sega's own adaptation for SG-1000.
I'm sorry, I don't want to point any fingers here, but we are here in the Nutmeg State. I expect some applause when we say the word ColecoVision. That is the Connecticut Leather Company. Please, let's respect them and their leather.
We had a hand in both the Fairchild Channel F and the RCA Studio 2 as well.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
Connecticut, rise
you
up.
Personally. Thank you.
So what is this part of the world called? Silicon what?
Swamp.
Silicon's. I don't think Connecticut's a swamp.
No, it's not a swamp. It's just the first biome that came to mind.
Silicon Forest? I don't know. Anyway, go Connecticut. So, yeah, like, those are, you know, fundamentally how Nintendo used, and Nintendo and Sega used Ikegami's talents in very different ways. I also want to point out the difference between Mario Brothers. This is kind of cheating. This is not the arcade version. This is the Game Boy Advance version that came in every single Game Boy Advance ever published.
Yes.
You got sick of it after a while, but it's still a cool, fundamentally good game where you have two people fighting each other or working together. Versus Sega's kind of take on the tiered platformer Flicky, which is, you know, much less about kind of making use of this limited space and finding cool ways to interact with the floors and the turtle shells and how you can mess up the other player. And it's just about a bird running around trying to protect its kid, grabbing all the kids, trying to lead them to safety while throwing coffee mugs and handguns at cats. One of those games is very much kind of like a social dynamic arises around it with Mario Brothers with two players, whereas Flicky is still just, you know, very much about human versus computer, as it should be. Another game here, Donkey Kong 3, is Nintendo's take on the shooter, one of the last arcade games they made, and it's kind of Space Invaders-ish, and for some reason you're blasting a monkey in the butt with poison, which is
like you do.
A strange choice, but, you know, it...
Well, if you don't, they start to infest, and then you got a problem.
So, you know, I feel like a comparable work by Sega at the same time was Action Fighter, which is a very Zevius and Spy Hunter-inspired shooter. So, you know, again, really pulling from the arcade roots, pay no attention to the fact that I used a cheat code there. And
well, you pointed it out.
Sometimes you gotta to get the game footage. So, yeah, that's kind of the arcade legacy there. But you look on the home front also, and... To me, kind of the quintessential Nintendo game on NES, you know, Mario's important, but Zelda really is taking that RPG concept and making it accessible in a way that, say, Ultima 3 was not,
yeah,
or even Final Fantasy. There are no menus, really, aside from like the subscreen where you just kind of use a cursor to pick an icon that determines what weapons you hold. It's very immediate. You press the A button, you see there, and you throw a sword at something or stab it. Once you get sub-weapons, you use the B button to use that sub-weapon. It's very straightforward, but there's so much mystery to this game, so much trying to discover what's out there.
Burn every bush.
Exactly.
Burn every single bush.
It is a game that rewards exploration and discovery. And, you know, Sega played around with some of those concepts. This is the disk system version, so please pardon the extraordinary load time that I should have edited out here. Wow, going for it.
This is what we put up with.
Sorry, I should have made the noises to give it that authentic feel. You know, you look on the Sega side of things, and their equivalent to Zelda initially was this game, Pit Pot. Oh, look, you died because it's hard. Where you're not really, you're exploring some, but really what you're doing is just smashing up the dungeon. And then the other flip side of that is Fantasy Zone, a game where you are a cute little guy, kind of like Link, but instead this cute little guy is running around with wings because they're a spaceship. But ultimately, they're going to shops and they're buying stuff, just like Link does. So these are kind of like the two adaptations of the Zelda concepts as manifested on Sega Mark III.
And doesn't Fantasy Zone have this really strangely deep story? Like there's someone's father dies.
Yeah, there's like patricide. It's inspired by Star Wars.
But he's a little guy.
He's a cute little guy, but that's why the sequel is called Tears of Opa Opa.
Okay.
Literally because he's sad because 10 years ago he had to kill his dad. I'm not making this up. Anyway, so here we have a game that only showed up in Japan until Virtual Console many years later called Nazo no Murasame-jo, The Mystery of Murasame Castle. And it's, you know, you're a samurai running around in feudal Japan shooting ninjas and stuff. It's very exploration-based. You have to wander around the world and find things and go to castles. This is Sega's equivalent, which is called Sega Ninja or The Ninja, depending on which version you use. And it's basically Commando. So, again, I kind of feel like you look at these two games, and it's the essence of Sega versus Nintendo in a nutshell. One is about kind of finding your way around and exploring feudal Japan, and the other is just, like, go up until you kill a guy who has an afro and like a spinning weapon thing.
And don't get hit yourself.
Don't get hit yourself, because there's no space for that. Here we have Super Mario Brothers 2, which you know, is really, of all the Mario games, the one that is the most about just farting around and finding things. Like, all the worlds are sort of non-linear. There's a lot of doors to go through.
There's a lot of opportunities to kind of sequence break as well.
Yeah, for sure.
You can... The way that the characters are programmed, like, each one has a talent, and particularly Luigi and Princess can break the game with their crazy-ass jumps. And I remember doing clever things, like, in the first stage where you... with Luigi, you get kind of a super jump going and going, like, past the whole underground part or the cave part, and being so proud of myself that I discovered that. The game is just full of things like that.
Yeah, and Mario 2 does not have a timer. It's hard to imagine a Mario game without a timer, and yet there's Mario 2.
Mario 2 has no timer, no points.
Yes.
It does use lives, but then it has the slot machine to get more lives, so it's like, it's so, to me, it's one reason I love Mario 2 so much, is the whole thing is built around messing around with it, going back to it, trying with different characters, trying to see what you can get away with, and, you know, writing up Nadia's point, I believe it's 4-3, there's a point where you can take a running jump with Luigi, and you skip a massive chunk of the stage, and even in Nintendo Power, they lie to you. They say, oh, don't even try this jump. Not even the princess. Not even the princess can make this jump because she hovers, right? And I remember reading that magazine. I'm like, Nintendo, how do I know your game better than you know it? Luigi is the man here.
Someone slept under their desk for a week designing that tower. You are going to play it. So another thing that I didn't capture footage for, but another thing that really manifests in the fundamental differences between Nintendo and Sega's kind of past and heritage is that Nintendo made its home consoles and accessories to last. And Sega, it took them a while to get to that point. If you have played an original SG-1000 or even a Mark III system, like those controllers, God bless you if it is actually reading your inputs, because they just wear out. Whereas Nintendo, when they launched the original Famicom, there was like a small defect that showed up in like 0.1% of all units, and they recalled the whole shebang. And you know, anyone who bought that original run of Famicoms could send it back and get a new model that had that ironed out. And in the process, they also said, hey, maybe like soft rubber square keys are not the best idea for something that's going to be pressed a lot because they stick after a while. So they replaced those with the hard round rubber or plastic buttons that we know today. Whereas Sega just kind of said, whoops, let's put out a new hardware revision. Let's put out the SG-1002, and then a year after that you have the Mark III, and then the year after that you have the Master System. And they just kept kind of pumping out new hardware to replace it, because that's what you do in arcades. You put out new machines. You're like, well, this one's run its course, so hey, arcade vendors, why don't you buy another machine from us, a different one that's better? It's got Superscalar. Hey, now this Superscalar has twice the memory, so it can do twice as many sprites. And, you know, Nintendo has certainly been guilty of these kind of iterative approaches, especially on DS and 3DS.
Oh, yeah.
But they tended to go do a slower roll, you know? You didn't have the Super NES CD-ROM expansion and then the Super NES 32X, whereas Genesis did do that. And, you know, there's stop gaps and, like, hey, what can we do to kind of put things, you know, to kind of stay in the lead for the hardware and have the most impressive specs on the market for just a little longer? That was kind of pervasive with Sega.
Yeah, and Nintendo really kind of exercised that whole, oh, we're hanging on thing with Donkey Kong Country, and just they really got a lot more life out of the SNES with that. And yeah, they canceled the CD, as we all know by now, but that was probably beneficial given how Sega, I think they kind of sank themselves by putting up too many in-between consoles. And, well, not to say Nintendo didn't. We had the Virtual Boy, which, no, it never existed. Everyone, come over here for your memory flash. It never existed.
So I think, you know, you end up with Sega putting out really great, powerful hardware that cost a little more, and Sega or Nintendo putting out less powerful hardware that costs less. I mean, that's certainly the case with Switch. And what bad effect has that had for Switch? It's like the third best-selling console ever at this point, right after PlayStation and DS.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
It's catching up to those. So that's clearly served them well. Sega was much more about the, you know, the traditional console razor and blade approach. You buy the razor with a low margin, and then you buy the blades, the games. And that's worked really well for Sony and Microsoft. But the thing is, Sony and Microsoft have other businesses to fall back on.
Yeah.
Sony has, you know, music, movies, other hardware, little robot dogs, things like that.
Insurance,
yeah,
do
there you go.
Do they do insurance?
Sony shells insurance, yes.
Oh, my God.
Microsoft basically has the entire PC market, the operating systems. Sega, you know, I think the reason they ultimately had to step away from hardware is because their other business was also high power, low margin. It was arcade machines. There's not a lot of profit in arcade machines unless you have a runaway hit like Street Fighter II or Pac-Man or something. Otherwise, it's pretty razor thin.
Especially
so Sega was kind of
the timeline, you know.
Like yeah.
The Dreamcast officially died early 2001, which is when arcades were basically dying their second biggest death. You know, they were rapidly falling out in America, and they were also falling out in Japan. It just took longer and went slower, but still, even in 2001, the arcade market was way smaller than it was, say, 10 years earlier, 1991.
I think it was hanging on because of DDR.
Yeah, I mean, there were a variety of experiences that kept it afloat. But yeah, you look at that, you know, look at the timeline of when did Dreamcast die? It's also when arcades were doing really, really badly. So Sega's like, what do we do? And they decided, okay, well, let's just make games and let's worry less about hardware.
Yeah, so I think we are just about out of time, which surprises me. I thought we were going to be, like, flailing up here. But no, there's so much to say. I can monologue for so long. But I do want to end, you know, just kind of looking at it maybe the quintessential Nintendo versus Sega, which is Super Mario World versus Sonic the Hedgehog. Both of these games are 2D platformers. Both look great. Both are a lot of fun. But Super Mario World is literally a game that wants you to poke around in every possible corner. It has hidden exits. Half the stages are hidden, and you have to find them. Whereas Sonic the Hedgehog, there's the opportunity to explore and look off to the side and, you know, find things. It's not just a game about going fast. But you do have to maintain a certain level of momentum when you're playing. Otherwise, you can't make certain jumps. And it's not a game that really allows you to explore everything in a stage in one go. Like, if you try to follow all the paths, you're basically going to ruin the game for yourself. You're going to run out of time, or you're going to run out of momentum. It's a game that, you know, again, with that classic Sega style, it wants you to replay it and, you know, play the same stages over and over again. But this time around, you know, the reward for playing the stages over and over again is not only that you get better at it, but you find new stuff. So you kind of have that arcade mentality shifting to one that is more exploration-based, but it's still a very sort of granular, divided design where it's, you know, you can't do everything all at once. You have to let it go and just, you know, get the most out of this one experience and then go back and try it again and see what's different.
Shout out to Sega at the time, though, how they took that methodical, they took those methodical Nintendo games and just turned that against them with their marketing by saying, look how cool and fast Sega games are. Look at these slow-ass Nintendo games. I still love the fact that they just completely dunked on Mario Kart with the blast processing thing. Like, they had a whole commercial about it. And look, you know, what if you don't have blast processing and you have, like, you know, Mario Kart, like, trundling along, and it's like Mario Kart, the most popular game franchise in the entire world. But that was actually really great marketing, as obnoxious as it was.
I do want to, one final thing for me is to say that Nintendo, or that Sega, really kind of perfected the Sonic the Hedgehog model of replay the stages, find new stuff, with OutRun, a game that is, you know, in 1986 was mind-blowing. Like, this racing game was incredible. It felt so good. It still looks cool. It's like, go get the Sega Ages version on Switch. It's phenomenal. But the thing about OutRun is that every once in a while, the road forks, and you can't possibly go on every route in a single playthrough. That's literally impossible because you have to go one way or the other. But every time you play, it means you can explore a different branch of the road. You can have a different arcade experience. You can focus on one part of the road, one path, and get really, really good at it. Or you can say, what else is out there? And, you know, you'll keep playing and get really, really good at those other paths because the game is just that good. That's the essence of Sega arcade design confidence, that you are going to want to keep putting quarters into this game and play it and play it and play it and explore every permutation of it because it's so good. And, you know, there's something really appealing, not only about the game, but just about that mindset, about that sort of sense of confidence. Anyway, that's all I've got. What about you two? Final words here.
Me?
Yeah, Diamond.
Do it.
They make good games. Seriously, we started with the premise, and no surprises here. They're both, you know, companies with very long histories, and they've made a lot of fantastic, you know, not just games, but they've created a lot of fantastic characters and ideas that have been iterating over and over again for these decades. And it's just, you know, this summer marks the 40th anniversary of both of them officially getting into the console business. And even though Sega doesn't do consoles anymore, they're still out there making weird games, and they're still out there, and people still love these games. And it's exciting. It's fun to see this, and it's almost heartwarming that they had this sort of faux rivalry, which was mostly in America, because they weren't like casting shit at each other in Japan the same way. But now here they are, and they're, you know, you got Mario and Sonic going to the Olympics together, and everyone's happy with that.
Yeah, but Mario Wonder will be launching very close to the new Sonic game in this fall, so warming up that old conflict. I think it's, thinking about it, the bane of Sega might have been the 32 and 64-bit era, because Nintendo by that point had a huge, you know, repertoire of games that you could take hours to explore through, like Zelda, Mario, et cetera, whereas Sega is... their whole thing was bringing over arcade ports, and they took a lot of pride in how accurate some of those ports were, as they should have, but people weren't really big on buying, like, I don't know, House of the Dead or whatever, and you know, the whole thing lasts for an hour. And the whole, it, like, lasts for an hour, and then, like, okay, well, the game's done, now what? And just, I guess in the era of bringing games home and paying a lot of money for them, and having it last, like, you know, a few hours, was starting to kind of fall out of vogue a little bit.
It's funny you said that, Nadia, because I'm the weirdo who is basically almost all my Dreamcast games were arcade ports. Some of them from Japan, where they cost extra.
All right, so that is all the time we have. We're about to get Boom Shakalaka off stage.
Boom Shakalaka.
So don't want that to happen. Thanks, everyone, for joining and coming out once again to Retro World Expo to hear us, little us, talk about video games. Go out on the floor and play some of these games. They're so good. And thanks. We'll see you hopefully next year.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for joining us. I'm really sorry I took this long. Thank you to Dan for saving our lives. And yes, we are, well, I am personally part of the Acts of the Blood God podcast. My name is Nadia Oxford. Thank you so much. Our podcast covers, you know, RPGs mostly, Eastern, Western, old and new. But for this particular panel, I thought I'd just do something stupid, because that is my wheelhouse. And I just kind of got interested in the subject of Link and Zelda's romance. Like, sometimes it seems like it's a sure thing in some of the games, and sometimes it seems like it's going to destroy the timeline. So, we're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, I want to introduce my panel guests, my very good friends. First, beside me.
Hello, everybody. My name is Diamond Fight. And is anyone else wondering what happened when Link got someone else's left hand? I mean, seriously. Come on.
Raru is watching. Raru knows your sins. Next, please.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish. I've had a lot of coffee today, so if I suddenly disappear, it's because I've vibrated between the dimensions like The Flash. Don't be alarmed.
The Flash? The hit movie?
Yes, the hit movie.
Or something.
Totally. Microwave Baby or something.
Microwave a Baby.
Oh, geez. I missed something. Okay.
You missed me.
Or you missed nothing, as the case may be.
And next, please. Is there anyone else?
No, that was
it's
it.
Just
it's
us.
Just the three of us.
Okay. I can sit over there if you'd like. I can do two characters.
Okay, we have Eliyahu. So we're going to... you're the only one who got that.
I will say, though, Nadia, that you're an RPG podcast talking about Zelda, and there are a lot of angry people in the YouTube comments who will let you know that Zelda is not a role-playing game. Thank you very much.
Yeah, in the Acts of the Blood Guy, we have plenty of people who let us know their opinions on whether or not Zelda is an RPG, and our outlook is, well, okay, it inspired so many RPGs for one thing, and you look at Tears of the Kingdom and tell me that's not an RPG, I'm not even talking to you. I got better things to do with my life. So.
Oh, that's way nicer than my perspective, which is shut up.
Well, that's what I'm getting to. I'm just being wordy about it. So let's talk a little bit about you know, what the whole thing going on here is. Link and Zelda, they're from, you know, of course, the long-lived Legend of Zelda series, and they tend to get together when fate draws them together, and whether or not they stick as a couple, it tends to vary. So, usually they're both required to take down Ganon. And so I thought, you know, let's look at some of these depictions. We'll start from the first game. And I've always wanted to kind of delve into the emotional health of Keebler elves. So, here we are. Now, who is Link? Link is the main protagonist of the Zelda games, starting with the first one in 1986 for the NES or Famicom disk system, if you like. He has the iconic hat, unless you're playing Tears of the Kingdom or Breath of the Wild, and in that case you have to basically literally go to hell to find his classic outfits, which I did, because they're pretty cool. And he's almost always the one who is charged with yanking out the Master Sword, like the Sword in the Stone, also known as the Sword of Evil's Banes, or the Sword that Seals the Darkness, and whatever it is, Link just has to stick it in Ganon's forehead and save the world. His physical appearance varies, Link's that is. Sometimes he resembles 90s-era Leonardo DiCaprio, and I'm pretty sure that was on purpose. I wrote an article about that back in the olden days. There was a lot of complaints in Skyward Sword about how he resembled Justin Bieber, and I'm not going to deny that, but it was pretty funny. and of course, you have the Wind Waker controversy, which some people say like he looks like the cartoon drawn by Don Hertzfeldt with his left hand. If you remember, rejected. That's like an old meme. I kind of had to shove in there. They're wrong, of course. The Wind Waker Link looks great. Wind Waker still looks great. Link is left-handed, or he used to be, and then Nintendo went back on this because of motion control, not because they're cowards. Doesn't talk much, but he is really good at exclaiming "Hiya" and "Ah." I'm not going to scream that over the microphone. He embodies the spirit of the hero that's fated to be reborn whenever evil starts kind of effing around in Hyrule or elsewhere. Sometimes he's born in like humble roots. Sometimes he's actually part of a line of knights and is guarding the royal family. But whatever he does, he has a hero's heart, and he's always a worthy bearer of the Triforce of Courage. What do you guys think of Link? Is he, like, your hero, or is he just kind of a dude who hangs around Zelda?
I like to think of him as the guy who shows up, you know? And I feel like the more recent games really embody this, because you don't really get a sense of those games. Like, people recognize him. It's like, oh, hey, it's you. And some people, like, talk about him. Like he, you know, like he's like some sort of myth or a legend. Then they recognize him as kind of like, oh, it's you. And sometimes they're just like, oh, it's you. You know, like there's all these levels of reaction. And like, unless you're part of that evil ninja clan, everyone sort of reacts to him in sort of varying degrees of, you know, affability.
I love the Yiga clan, because in Tears of the Kingdom, like there's actually an option you can give to talk to the Yiga clan, and you can say like, Master Koga has a dumb belly, and they're all really big on Master Koga and his belly, so they get really pissed off and will immediately launch at you with hooks. What about you, Paris? What do you think?
I mean, which Link are we talking about here specifically?
All Links.
You know, there are different types of Links. There's like sleepy lobster pajama Link.
Yeah, the jam cans.
And yeah, like he's just a cute little guy who goes off and accidentally saves the world by sailing around a lot. But then there's, you know, the original Link, who is basically, like, you know, if you look at the artwork in the Zelda manual for NES, he's like an 8-year-old, and the entire world is like, hey, kid, here's a sword. Go save the country. That's a lot to ask of someone who can't even, like, drive or vote yet.
Well, he can walk. You're going to walk to Mount Doom and do it, dude.
But, you know, I think it's admirable that no matter what Link's age is, he takes up the sword and, as you say, sticks it in Ganon's head.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to go somewhere. It may as well go in his head. He's lucky it goes in his head. If it was me, it's somewhere else.
No labor laws in Hyrule, I guess.
It's good for the kids. The experience is good for the kids. And then we have Princess Zelda, who is the gal the games are named after. You are not going to play as her unless you play the CDI games. So,
not really the best showing for Zelda, in my opinion.
Certainly not, yeah.
Or Smash Brothers. You can play as Zelda in
Smash. You're right. Okay, I'm sorry. I am corrected.
She is a Smash Brother somehow.
She's a really good Smash Brother. I can't play her because she's too light and airy, but she's very good. She is the reincarnation of the goddess Hylia, who gave up her immortality to become the bearer of Triforce of Wisdom. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I try to make sense of it, but it's good enough for me.
I mean, they already did that in Lunar Lucia, who was the goddess Althina or whatever. I can't remember who was what. But anyway, Luna was the goddess Althina, but then gave up her immortality.
They put on the mortal pants, and that was
or
the end of that.
Or non-pants in Luna's case.
Oh, right. Of course. That
does the goddess in a thong.
No clothes for the goddess. Unlike the hero fated to protect her, she's actually quite chatty, but not as chatty as the Master Sword. Her personality varies a lot from game to game. She can be very serious, she can be very playful, she's even a pirate in one case. There was an incident outlined in the instruction booklet for Zelda 2, wherein one of the earlier Princess Zeldas was put into a deep sleep thanks to her brother's stupidity, and in his grief, said brother ordered every female child in the royal household to be named Zelda. Not confusing at all. It really only helped untangle the Zelda timeline. So
I assume they all got Roman numerals at the end, like Zelda the 21st and that sort of thing.
It would be like, you know, when you look at the credits for movies and it has like the long like string of dates all written in Roman numerals.
Zelda Junior Junior.
Yeah, yeah.
Never talk to me or my princess ever again.
Do you guys have a favorite Princess Zelda?
Well, I kind of like the more recent incarnation in that she seems to have a lot on her mind, and she seems to be actively working on things. Mm-hmm. You know, the games, you know, still find ways to sort of lock her in a hellhole or transform her into some sort of freak. But at least when she's there and she's sentient and she's talking, she seems like she's invested in what's going on, you know, which I enjoy more than, say, someone who just sort of stands very still and then gets kidnapped and then disappears again and then appears later in a gem. And it's like, okay, well.
Well, I mean, there's fire in front of her and someone has to come by and hit it. Otherwise, she can't go anywhere. It's fire.
That does seem like a very flammable gown she's wearing.
Yeah. I actually like her very much as well in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, where they are traveling together and doing their best to restore Hyrule. Like, I think that's a really cool incarnation of Zelda. I think what they did with her in Tears of the Kingdom was great, too. That was a great game. Parrish, do you have a favorite?
I mean, I don't think Zelda had much of a personality to speak of until Ocarina of Time.
That's
so
true.
It's kind of hard to like any of those as anything other than just like, you know, the cipher at the end that you're trying to reach. But I'm going to go with the dark horse choice here and say Spirit Tracks Zelda, because she is a ghost that follows you around in a haunted suit of armor and kills things for you and solves puzzles alongside Link. And that's pretty awesome.
Spirit Tracks is so underrated. Like, who's with me on that one? I love Spirit Tracks. Yeah. All right.
That's right. You're allowed to stay.
Except for the boss. The boss, the end boss was just like, oh my God, you can't be throwing this gimmick at me now. So let's proceed to the first game, Legend of Zelda. We're kind of just going to take a quick look at how they relate to each other here. This was written and programmed in the era of dudes rescuing girls from bigger, nastier dudes, and that's all you're really getting for a plot in those days. They had 128K. Gotta do. You don't need more than that for a letter, as the song goes. So there's not really much to the Link and Zelda relationship in the first game. They defeat Ganon. He rescues Zelda because that's what a hero does. They do each lift up a Triforce at the end of the game, so that might be a marriage proposal. That might be a Hyrule tradition. I don't know. I can't tell you. But I will say I think, you know, they were destined to be together, except there is a caveat to this, and I will get to that. So this is a very simple opening relationship, nothing really to you know, expand upon, unless you have any thoughts about the Zelda 1, Link and Zelda.
Well, I'm starting to wonder now, because, you know, Link walks into the room, and he's got a Triforce, and he kills Ganon and takes Ganon's chunk of the Triforce, which means one of them has been pieced together over the course of many, many hours, and one of them was sitting inside Pigman and is covered in dust. Which one do you think Link got the hold of, and which one did Zelda hold up?
Oh, he took the Ashes one. I would. That's metal.
I mean, does Zelda there have gloves? I can't see from this angle. It might be okay.
I don't think she does.
But yeah, I think you're right about the marriage ceremony. What you don't see is they hold up the Triforces, and then they smash them to the ground and play to the Greek wedding and say, opa!
Mazel tov.
Exactly. And that's why you have to collect the 8 pieces of the Triforce.
Oh, because someone...
It's cyclical. Yeah, that's why there's the second quest.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I like that. New canon, everyone. Someone write this down for Nintendo.
But I also want to shout out that, you know, I do like that no matter what happens when you finish the first Zelda game, Zelda's always wearing a dress the same color as Link's dress.
Yes.
And it's not at all has to do with memory capacity. It's just Nintendo wanted that to happen, you know?
They wanted to coordinate because it is a marriage after all. It is a wedding, at least for a little while, because then we get to Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link. And basically, talk about love. Link goes through an entire dimension flip for this game. He flattens himself. And here's the thing about Zelda 2, like, you're not really saving Zelda from the first game here. This is, you're on a quest for MacGuffins that will let you get the third Triforce and wake up Eepy ancestor Zelda, who's laid out in her brother's enormous bedroom, which is totally not creepy. Everything's fine. I think one of you added to this, he's also saving himself from Ganon's minions. Saving Zelda seems far less urgent by comparison because they want Link's blood. This is absolutely true. Actually, you mentioned the ashes in the first Zelda. That pile of ashes actually becomes a character of its own almost in Zelda 2, where the instruction book explicitly says, like, to revive Ganon, you have to sprinkle the blood of Link on Ganon's ashes, which is a very kind of Christian... It was a Christian enough allegory that my Jewish self was like, that's kind of weird, but... So Link uses the Game Genie to beat the Thunderbird. Because come on, let's be realistic here. He stabs Shadow Link repeatedly in the knees. He gets a third Triforce. Strange Zelda wakes up and just immediately plays tonsil hockey with him. And can you imagine? It's like a mega morning breath. That must be terrible. Like, she's been lying there for I don't know how many years. But so for the verdict, I put a shrug emoji because I don't even know what to say about this. What do you guys have anything to
I mean,
add?
I guess the subtitle should be Any Zelda in a Storm, right? Because, like, he's, you know, you would think there'd be some loyalty or at least some sort of... you know, debt to the other Zelda I guess she either vanished or she quit or she gave up or she hooked up with someone else. And he's like, okay, well, I'll wake this other Zelda. Thank you very much.
This is on screen for 5 seconds, so it's debatable as to whether she's in this game.
That's a good point, yeah. She gets her own, like, sitting up sprite, too.
There's no reason whatsoever for them to have made this as complicated as they did in the manual. In the game, there's no reason this couldn't have just been, you know, Ganon's minions want to revive Ganon. They put Zelda under a sleeping spell. You gotta wake her up again. It could have been that easy. But no, there's like 20 pages of backstory in the manual that are like, so actually, let's tell you about incest. It gets kind of weird. And it's really unnecessary.
And I never read that part until like recently.
Really?
So like during, I think, our Zelda timeline episode we did a few months ago, that was when I was hit by this sledgehammer. It's like, wait a second, there's a different Zelda and it's... Yeah, there's a whole explanation as to why it's a different Zelda instead of just, you know, me as a kid in 87, I'm like, oh, that's Zelda. There she is. You know, the game says Zelda. That's Zelda.
She is here.
And now I rescue Zelda. Okay, it's shockingly simple, except it isn't.
Parrish, you're like the expert on all things Nintendo. Do you have any idea why they went so hard for the story for Zelda 2?
I really don't understand. And I thought it might have been like something they made up for the American version, but then I dug up the Famicom Disk System manual, and it's like, it's the same thing. It's all the same artwork,
so,
and it just goes on and on and on about how there was a prince with a whip and a ghost thing that haunted him from behind and cursed the princess, and she fell asleep, and he was all sad and decided, all my children are going to be named Zelda from now on and unto the 20th generation. It's just bizarre. I don't understand, but... You mentioning the Christian allegory makes me wonder, like, what is the Eucharist of Link? This is actually a burning question.
You eat his hat. Eat this fabric, for it is my hat. Interesting side note here quickly. I think I've said this before on the show, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but in Canada, the instruction booklet had to be French and English by law. So whereas we had the whole story, it cut a lot of the artwork. So my husband, who's from America, I'm looking at his copy of the instruction booklet. I'm like, holy shit, there's so much here that we didn't have, except for it was all in French. Le Zelda, I don't know. I'm very bad. I don't know French very well, even though I'm Canadian. So moving right along to Link to the Past. Now, this is an interesting one because it establishes a psychic connection between Link and Zelda. This was the first time as a stupid teenager, not even a teenager, I was very young when I played this, and I was starting to get into romance and stuff like that, I realized, okay, this is starting to get to my heart. I like these two kids. And they don't go into detail about what happened after Zelda was rescued, even though they kept the psychic link, but the Nintendo Power comic by legendary mangaka Shotaro Ishinomori. Ishinomori, thank you. Implies that the psychic link between them, since it broke, they drifted apart, and they were no longer in love, and that was actually a very sad ending to that comic.
I never actually took that to be specifically a psychic bond between them. I thought Zelda was just, like, doing the Radio Free Europe thing and just kind of, like, sending out an open signal, and Link just happened to be, you know, the most receptive to that.
His uncle.
But also his uncle, yeah.
Yeah, so it might be a bloodline thing. It does mention in, like, some of the supplementary materials as well as the instruction book, probably, is that some Hylians can hear psychic messages, so I don't know if it's at all of them or Link's line has something going on, but the you know, is
they
stronger.
They were just flipping through the AM stations and yeah. They picked up these broadcasts from
I'm going to listen to CCR instead. I see.
I mean, the first three rules, right? Location, location, location. Like those, you know, Link and his uncle lived in that little hut, and they were by far the closest residents to the castle. Like, the village was way the hell west. You know, yeah. All those other people. There's people in the mountain. They're not going to come down from the mountain for this.
Cuckoos were like, whoa, who is this girl talking to me? I can't do anything about it. I'm a chicken.
I can kill someone if I want to, though.
It's true. They could all team up.
You trigger me, I will kill you. I do want to give a quick shout-out to A Link Between Worlds, which was an excellent, I don't know if you call it a sequel or a retelling or whatever it was. It did seem to continue the story of Zelda 3 a little bit. I called it Zelda 3. Oh, my God.
It's all right.
A Link to the Past a little bit because...
It's canon. It's on the Super NES box.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm right. I'm right. I'm okay. So it takes place apparently centuries after A Link to the Past. Who wrote that? Was that me? I guess that was me.
But, it was me.
Okay. But according to the in-game text in that game, in A Link Between Worlds, there is a mural in Hyrule Castle that depicts a quote-unquote hero holding the princess. And it could very well be Link to the Past's Link and Zelda, but Zelda is apparently very fond of that mural and looks at it all the time. I think that Link's feelings for Zelda become clear when he winds up on Koholint Island and mistakes Marin for Zelda. They fall in love, but unfortunately Marin becomes a seagull and flies away to her home planet because I guess they need her there. Either way, I do say this is like a destined couple. I do think that they did get together at the end. Do you have any arguments about that?
I just want to say that if you look at the Japanese ad for Link to the Past with the live actors and the rapping and the dancing,
yeah.
I believe that Link and Zelda are definitely a couple.
I
at least they
this.
Hook up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
They hooked up at the club. I accept this. I accept this canon. Do you have any thoughts, Parrish?
I mean, I don't know. Like, Link turns into a fluffy pink bunny in the other world.
So cute.
That's irresistible. Come on.
Yeah.
Who would turn that down?
I do think that, just saying off the record here, that I think that Twilight Princess missed a beat by not making him pink bunny in the dark world instead of a wolf.
That would have had a different vibe to it, for sure.
For sure, yeah. But it would have been cute to have a pink bunny in that very dark, weird
I guess
game.
It could have been, you know, the bunny from Monty Python.
covered in
the,
blood?
Yeah, see, the attack bunny.
Run away, run away. And we'll go into Link's Awakening here, including a gif of Link being poked with a stick because it's irresistible. Link is so down bad for Zelda that when he gets dunked in the sea during a separate adventure, he dreams up an entire narrative that sees him potentially live forever in peace with quote-unquote her. But is Marin really a replacement for Zelda, or does Link love her as her own person? It doesn't matter, because he's going to play the Battle of the Windfish in front of that stupid egg no matter what, and Koholint will dissolve like tears in the rain. So I just put a Freud reference here because, you know, I'm sure he'd like to take a look into Link's mind, but... Man, what a great game. What a heartbreaking game. I will say very, very proudly that I saw Symphony of the Goddess, and they did the ending for Link's Awakening, and I cried because it was very sad. So, I mean, this is one of the most highly ranked games. I mean, I love the relationship between Link and Marin in this one. Do you think she's an allegory for Zelda, or is she your own problem? I almost said her own problem. Is she her own person?
I mean, it's not his dream, though, right? Is it his dream or the Windfish's dream?
That's true. It's the Windfish's dream.
I mean, there's obviously some, you know, there's some sort of connection there because he's dreaming the dream too, or he's in the dream, but he wakes up. But I mean, he asks about Zelda when he wakes up, so clearly Zelda's on his mind.
Yeah.
You know, he's on a strange island, is not really expected to call out for Zelda right away because she wasn't on the boat, you know.
Yeah.
But for some reason, he's like, oh, I'm awake. Where is Zelda? The answer is Zelda's not here. You will not find Zelda, but you'll find this weird, quirky village full of happy people and this lovely singing girl, and you'll get to know her, and eventually he'll pick her up. And, like, literally pick her up and celebrate the fact that you're with her now. So I don't think – I feel like it's a different take. I feel like one of the many beautiful things about that game is the fact that they felt freedom to, like, okay,
yeah,
let's not put Zelda in here. Let's have a girl talk to Link, and let's have her talk to Link, and she'll do stuff, and she'll just be a person that he can meet instead of, you know, a prize. And I think that's wonderful.
It was really nice. And definitely one of my favorite couples for that reason.
Even though he picks her up, literally.
This could be your chance.
I love that line.
So, you know, Link's Awakening, as we all know, was heavily inspired by Twin Peaks. And looking at this animated GIF, I just realized that Link is Laura Palmer. The story starts with him, his body being found on the shore.
No plastic, though.
No plastic, but ultimately what that tells me is that everyone loves Link, but is destined never to be able to have him.
Aww.
So I don't know if it even matters, because Link is, he's ephemeral.
That's true. That's true.
We have to wait for the movie to discover his interiority.
Oh, God, it's going to happen now, isn't it?
Mm. Does this also mean Link's on coke?
He's always on coke.
Potentially.
How can you not be on coke if you're expected to save the world?
What do you think those heart containers are?
Just packed full of coke.
He gets more powerful with every one. More energetic.
This one's heroin. Black tar heroin. I just love that she's poking with a stick, because in the game, like, she shakes him, and I thought, okay, I'll put a gif of that up, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is a really good gif of him being coked with a stick. Next is Biggie, Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. This is another instance of Link changing his whole dimensions to save a princess, and they meet as kids, and it's very cute. They want to save the world in that adorable little childlike way, and it all goes wrong. And Link is forced to undergo turbo puberty. And so does Zelda, but she doesn't have an ocarina sign to ease her through it. Like, she's got to go through the whole thing, as well as becoming a Sheikah in the process. Link and Zelda meet several times. Link doesn't know it because Zelda disguises herself as Sheik. But there is definitely some, like, 64-bit low poly tension between the two of them. And they protect each other and work as a team to dispatch Ganon. When it's done, though, Zelda sends Link back to his childhood, even though she's, like, clearly conflicted about doing so. But they do meet as kids again after the credits, so that could imply anything. But there is evidence in Twilight Princess that with the hero Shade, who is confirmed to be Link, like, is unhappy and restless. And I always found that extremely interesting, because you learn he might be unhappy because he just didn't have a fulfilling life after, you know, he turned in Ganon and kind of prevented the world from being destroyed the first time around. So I can't really say that's because he never wound up with Zelda, but maybe that has something to do with it. I do know it's mostly because he couldn't pass down his skills until he finally met someone and said, oh, thank God, finally someone I can give my murder moves to, because they wouldn't let me teach this to my kids. So, but yeah, the thing with Ocarina of Time as well is the timeline split game. So I said, yes, they are in love. It is destined, but it's also doomed because it broke the timeline. And I think a lot of people kind of have resentment for that. What do you guys think about Ocarina of Time, Zelda, and Link?
Well, I think it's interesting because, first of all, while Link is out doing his business and traveling around Hyrule, there is also the relationship he has with the Zora daughter.
The Ruto, yeah.
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 So there's some tension there where she's into Link and Link is not into her.
And don't forget about Saria.
Yeah, there's also that sort of another childhood sort of crush, I guess. But then you have the Sheik thing, and you've got Sheik showing up throughout the adult timeline and then eventually revealing Sheik herself to be Zelda, or himself to be Zelda. Not sure about pronouns there. And I have to wonder, when Sheik turns into Zelda, do you think Link said, "Oh, thank God," or, "Wait, go back"?
Or, "How fast can you switch?"
Things just got more interesting.
Hey, this quest rules.
So at the end of Ocarina of Time, the Hyrule chronology, the timeline, splits into three. So in my mind, there's the Link got together with Zelda timeline, the Link didn't get together with Zelda timeline, and the Link got together with all the ladies.
And good for him.
They hung out at the corner of the club and said, "Hey, we saw you across the room and we like your vibe."
We saw you at the
swinger timeline.
I actually love how in Wind Waker, one of the timelines is Link does not show up when they call for a hero, so they ask the gods, and the gods just dump a ton of water on him. So there you go. It's the best I can do. I'm an Old Testament
cold
god.
Cold shower timeline.
Yeah. Wake up, bitches. Next we have, speaking of water, the Wind Waker, where we talked about earlier, Link is a sleepy boy in lobster jammy jams, and Zelda is a pirate. She becomes a princess for a moment, but she gets better, and she becomes a pirate again. And at the end of the game, they kind of sail off to find new adventures outside of, like, you know, Hyrule, or New Hyrule, or whatever. And some people say that there's evidence in Phantom Hourglass that the two don't stick together. I didn't play Phantom Hourglass, so I don't know. But they're good kids. I'm going to let them have this one. I feel like Wind Waker, and I'll say this, I'll kind of get into this a little bit later, too, but Toon Link, as he's known in Smash, just seems to have his shit together when it comes to relationships. Like, he and Zelda are always, like, cute and adorable together, like we mentioned Spirit Tracks. I really like them as a couple. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a weird sort of Milhouse's parents thing going on here. Like, that
it's destiny.
They're both together, and they both really look like each other, which is sort of strange.
Right.
Like, are they cousins? But then again, I don't know. Maybe it's the Shelbyville of Hyrule. So
they're all the yellow fire hydrants.
I don't know. Like, it really bothers me that canonically Phantom Hourglass is not the direct sequel to Wind Waker, because it absolutely should be, by all rights. This is another one of those, like, jumping through too many hoops, like the Zelda 2 instruction manual backstory. Like, it's just that Zelda and that Link and that Lineback and that King of Red Dragon's boat all together again, finding the new lands that they set out to find at the end of of Wind Waker. So, you know, like, ignore what the canon says. Like, they got together. They're out having sailing adventures together, and it's awesome.
They're having a good time.
Yeah, for sure.
I wish I could sail all day. I'd probably throw up because I get seasick, but it'd be fun. Minish Cap. Now, here's an extremely overlooked game that I absolutely adored. And actually, Link and Zelda in this game, they start off as childhood friends. And the princess sneaks out a lot to meet with Link. And she actually plays a game early in the start of the game, and she wins a shield, and she gifts it to Link. So that's his, like, you know, trademark shield right there. And like I said earlier, like, all told, Toon Link just has his shit together when it comes to relationships. I mentioned Spirit Tracks, they're close homies in that. You're right, she does possess, like, a suit of armor or something like that. It's been a while since I played Spirit Tracks, so I don't remember why, but I think she died. She's like, oh, dear. That's one thing about Zelda.
I don't know if she's actually dead so much as just, like, trapped in the spirit realm, which I guess that's splitting hairs, but, you know, story and magic and stuff.
I think it was a Doctor Strange thing, right? Someone knocked her out of her body?
Maybe.
Yeah. Before Doctor Strange did that on the in the movies. No, that's a good point.
She got struck by the Wand of Wadatome.
There are
no idea if that's real. Sorry.
It's absolutely real. Okay. Not in the Zelda canon, though.
What's it called? The Wand?
The Wand of Wadatome?
The Wand of Wadatome.
I don't know.
That's a lot of W's.
Doctor Strange, whatever.
So there's not a lot to talk about when it comes to Toon Link, because, you know, he's got it together, unlike, you know, later games. Legend of Zelda, Twilight Princess. Now, this is also an interesting one, because there's just not a lot of romantic tension between Link and Zelda. Like, Link already has a squeeze in his home village. There's the whole Midna thing, which everyone has eyes for Midna anyway, so no one cares about Zelda. And Zelda herself, like, she's kind of mourning her kingdom, which is under the thrall of Zant, so she's not really in the mood. I don't think, look at this picture, nobody's in the mood. So. And frankly, it's probably a lot more fun for Wolf Link to go around peeing on everything anyway. So the verdict is, who needs love when you can be a dog? And what do you think? I think I'm right about that one.
I mean, that's like a Luigi death stare right there. What's going on?
I can't remember, but Zelda in that game was very, very no-nonsense. She was not there to play.
Did they dub that one? Did she have an English accent?
That's a good question. No, they didn't dub it.
There was no voice in that one.
There was no voice in that one.
From the usual...
Yeah, Link did all of that. But I feel like Midna was an interesting ad because that was definitely where all the tension was. I don't know if he even cared about the chick he grew up with, but she cared about him. So she's probably going to rope him into something soon later. I don't even remember her name. Something with an I.
Ilya?
Thank you. Ilya, yeah.
I mean, I actually forgot that Zelda was in this game. She's such a non-character in Twilight Princess. She's just kind of there because she has to be in a Zelda game because her name's on the cover.
Yeah.
Really, the game is about the relationship between Link and Midna for the most part. At least, you know, once you get out of that starting village after like 10 or 12 hours of gameplay.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, okay. The fish? Dear God, the fish. Did anyone else have a problem with that fish?
Yeah,
you were supposed to... It wasn't even like a normal fishing game. It was just... And I love fishing games in RPGs, don't get me wrong, but that was bad.
You're talking about the one that you had to smell?
Yes, the reek fish. That's it. And the cat had to get it and go up the tree and get the basket for the pregnant woman. It just made no sense at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Like a mousetrap.
It sounds like I'm doing like a song for children. And the fish took the cat and the cat... And like Farmer in the Dell or something. Now, here's an instance where it is very clear they are a couple. Maybe only the only game where it makes it very clear, other than the Breath of the Wild games, where they are a couple. They're absolutely disgustingly cute. I think that Skyward Sword, even though it didn't have the best gameplay, some people say, it had great dungeons. I love the characterization. I love the expressions. And they go on to found Hyrule at the end of the game. And, I mean, come on. You kind of get some, Left 4 Dead vibes here, where one man, one woman populating the whole planet because the Hylians have to become the dominant race somehow, and it's not going to be the Gorons. So, dear God, we have to breed faster than the Gorons.
I really hope genetics work differently in Hyrule than they do here, because otherwise, that's five or six generations on. It's they've got some challenges to face.
I think they mentioned moving the people on the sky to Hyrule, but there's not that many. There's one toilet in that whole place. I put the verdict is already getting down because they're busy. They got things to do. What do you guys think of this couple? I think the best one.
Yeah, they seem the most together in as opposed to, you know, questing for one another or fighting with one another or just sort of staring at one another without any emotion. So I would say yeah.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think they wanted Fi to be sort of the Midna of this game, but
yeah.
Fi is really just a little overbearing, and I feel like Link would be happy to have her transformed into a quiet sword and forgotten in the woods someplace so that he can go back to his sweetie.
We're going to put you in a rock. Trust me, it's tradition.
That's how it's always worked in my family.
Don't mock it. A Link Between Worlds. This is a great, great game, and one of my favorites for the relationship because like Link and Zelda, they do pine for each other silently, not unlike their ancestors in A Link to the Past, but this time you have the counters to Link and Zelda, which are Ravio and Hilda in Lorule, which is still a stupid-ass name, as much as I love this game. Whereas Link in the upper world in Hyrule wants to tell Zelda how he really feels, Ravio, who says through the whole game, like, I'm a coward, I'm nothing, I'll never be a hero, he says loudly and proudly, like, I care very much about Zelda, and I am doing this thing to save her. And it's just funny that Link is, like, the embodiment of courage, and he can't do that. But Ravio, the weird rabbit dude, can come right out and say it. Like, I loved Ravio. He was one of my favorite characters in the series. What do you guys like Ravio?
I did, but now I'm thinking, wait a second, didn't Mario also introduce a purple-looking thief thing? And
Nabbit.
Yeah.
Nabbit.
What? There can't be two. You can't have two purple thief things in Nintendo.
In this case, Rovio. Rovio is something else altogether.
Those are birds.
Rovio is a reference to Link's Shadow World form.
Yeah.
Wasn't he? Like a purple rabbit? Pink, purple?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. I never thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I took it to be.
And here I thought Nintendo forgot about the pink rabbit.
How could you forget about the pink rabbit?
I don't know. Ask Nintendo, not me, but it's I like that.
I think, doesn't the pink rabbit even show up in the Silent Hill games?
Oh, it does, but yeah, I don't know. So that's a little bit more of a...
R-A-B, rabbit.
There you go, yeah.
Isn't that rabbit covered with blood most of the time?
Yes.
I mean, it's, you know, it's the Shadow World. It's Link's true self.
There's actually one thing I really liked about A Link Between Worlds. They kind of took the canon and changed it in really interesting ways, like the Dark World... The canon in Link to the Past is if you go into the Dark World, you change into a monster because stuff. But in A Link Between Worlds, you have people who are living in Lowrul, and everything sucks, and everything's covered in monsters. And they wear animal masks to keep the monsters away. Like, I can't remember if it's a superstition or if it actually works, but everyone there is, like, dressed as a monster. And that was so interesting to me because even though you're not fighting these monsters like you did in A Link to the Past, they are there, and they have their own kind of... you know, reason for looking weird. And yeah, I guess I never realized the rabbit connection, so thank you for that. Either way, like, at
happy
least...
Happy to have been here.
What I can say is, at least in the Mirror Universe, like, some people there have some... At least there they have guts and admit that they love each other. So I think they're destined, but with caveats, like, they have to kind of get their mouths open and say something. Did you play a Link Between Worlds fight?
I absolutely did. It's just it's been a while, and it was on a tiny screen, so I'm struggling to remember the details of it. But I did. I can't help but think of how a few years later the purple thief thing appeared, and now I'm obsessed with this purple thief. And send help.
I actually think I might be misremembering this, but I think Nintendo did speak up about that and say no, they're not the same character. But why were they inspired to do that? As someone had bunnies on the mind, I guess.
You got Ravio and Nabbit. Combine them, you've got Rabbit. I don't know if this means anything, but I think that was the point that was being made out here.
Rabbit.
And it's going to haunt me.
So now that we've all kind of disturbed ourselves, we're going to move on to Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild / Tears of the Kingdom. Let's face it, they're kind of the same people, so we may as well just combine it into one. Slowest of slow burns, like talking about a century or so here. Link is Zelda's appointed knight. He follows her everywhere, and Zelda is understandably pissed about him tagging along like a puppy dog, but then love starts to bloom on a battlefield when Link saves her from a Yiga attack. Like, you get in that cinema, you can just see the like the flowers and the blush and everything. When Link is protecting Zelda from the Guardians, Zelda's power to seal away evil, which she's going nuts through the whole game trying to get this power to activate, it finally activates when she's protecting Link, which kind of says it all. And turns out standing in freezing water and waiting for something to happen, I wasn't doing anything for her. Impa's granddaughter, Paya, I think that's her name, she has, like, baby's first crush on Link and is very, very cute. But if you read her diary, if you're a bad person, you learn that she learns to control herself because she realizes, oh, Link really seems to love Zelda, so I'm going to step out of this one. And I'm just going to say, look, they moved in together in Tears of the Kingdom. Like, Nintendo will never say, yes, this happened, but it's obvious they're living together. They're inseparable because they travel together, and they are definitely shtupping. Like, it's just, it's happening. And I have some added text here from you fine people. And yet, I spent over 100 hours hunting Koroks, rebuilding a town, visiting shrines and light routes, and farming monster gusts before reuniting them. Because Zelda see Link do that the whole time. And did she see me read her diary? I hope so, because that's how I got her... I guess I got the new champion's tunic.
Yeah, that's the only way to find that little secret. Yeah, it's kind of strange that they sort of offhandedly mention that they're in the same house, and it's the same house that you buy in Breath of the Wild, right? Like, so Link bought this house, and then I guess Zelda moved in, but you have to wonder, since you never see them both in the house, what's the arrangement there? Are they indeed sharing the bed, or does Link just kind of sleep on the floor like the family dog? Like, does Link actually sleep?
That's Twilight Princess. Don't get them confused.
I guess given Link's habit of sleeping by fires, maybe he just sleeps outside by the little cooking fire outside next to the tree. Maybe this is his designated sleep zone.
Yeah, I guess that's possible, but I do know... Oh, Someone has a hand raised.
In the Japanese version, it actually, it's known as their house.
Oh, okay.
Like our house.
In the middle of our street.
More romantic ties in the Japanese version.
Ah, interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. That's really cool. Because, yeah, it just seemed to me like, okay, they're a couple. It makes no sense for them not to be a couple. And she does have that kind of hiding area in the house where she has the well where you find her diary. And she made him a whole new tunic. And as we all know by now, if you make someone armor in the Breath of the Wild universe, you are getting married. So what do you guys think? Like, I think it's a solid yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's got all the hallmarks, you know, and especially the fact that she has her own private hidden space inside the house. I mean, every married couple, everyone has their own little space somewhere, whether it's a man cave or a toilet, you know, it's just everyone among us who has a living relationship like that, you have your special hidden place.
Mine is the balcony because my husband's very scared of heights, so he's not coming out there.
You make it work. That's what it's marriage. Marriage is making it work.
It's mine and the pigeons.
Yeah.
I need to know why you put toilet in air quotes.
I don't believe in big toilet. But yeah, I think they're extremely cute together. And I'm going to miss them, put it that way, because we're probably not going to be adventuring with them in the next game. The ending to Tears of the Kingdom is very sweet.
Yeah, and I guess we also shout out the fact that in this one, Zelda is the stone. You know, we talked about Link pulling the magic sword out of a stone, the master sword out of a stone. In this case, she is the damn stone.
She is.
Right out of her noggin.
Well, so it's like Utena. Again. Was that? What?
It's like Revolutionary Girl Utena. Utena.
A lot like that, actually, now that you mentioned it.
Does it have the cool song, too?
No, unfortunately. But it does have you know, the Master Sword song has been around since, I think, the third game, so they still use it. And, yeah, that is... you all have to read this comic because it's very relevant. When I saw that, especially the horse named Big Chungus. Can you see it, Parrish?
I see it.
Something about a horse named Big Chungus. So, yeah.
So that's just Zelda, like, asking. You mentioned, one of you mentioned, like, why... Can Zelda see me wasting time and effing around instead of saving her? The answer is apparently yes.
I mean, I think it's debatable in Breath of the Wild, but in Tears of the Kingdom, she's up there. Like, what else is she doing?
Yeah, like, maybe she's... I don't know. When people say they're like, oh, I'm here stealing the darkness for however many years, it's like, what are you doing there? Are you just standing there? Are you, like, knitting? Or are you allowed to knit? Are you allowed to sit? You should unionize if you can't sit. But, thank you so very much for coming, unless you two have any additional insights to my disaster here.
Where do you stand on the oracles, Zelda's?
Is she in those?
I don't remember.
I don't think... Is she in the oracles?
Briefly.
No. Yeah, I didn't really include them, because number one, I didn't play Oracle games. Number two, I didn't think she was in them. So, I do stand...
Ganon's in there somewhere.
I do stand Link's horse. He has a cool horse.
Okay.
Yeah, so, what about you, Fight? Any additional...
Well, this unfortunately demands that we have a follow-up panel where we talk about Ganon and Zelda. Like, what is their deal?
Oh, that's
because obviously, you know, if you've got someone who repeatedly kidnaps someone over and over, you know, the sure to be Oscar-winning Super Mario Brothers movie taught us that Koopa loves Peach to the point that he actually songs about her. So, after almost many years, Ganon and Zelda must have. Something. Is Ganon obsessed with her? Does Ganon hate her? Does he just, you know, because you have that one moment in Tears of the Kingdom where he's got the biggest grin I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, scary.
And I took that picture. It's on my Switch somewhere. Just, I couldn't believe that grin. So
that was a hell of an A-plus, you know, grin.
And they made him very sexy also. They made Ganon very sexy in Tears of the Kingdom.
They actually gave, I can't remember the name of the artist, but there was an artist who was absolutely obsessed with Ganon within Nintendo apparently. And apparently they told her, go to town. This is yours. This is your boy. And next thing we know, he has a toe ring.
Yeah. So I feel like the demand for a sequel panel is there.
We'll see what we can do next year. Yeah, but this has been a lot of fun. I am, again, Nadia Oxford of the Axe of the Blood God and Retronauts, and You can visit us on bloodbathpod.com or retromouse.com. And yeah, how much time do we have? Because I'm not sure what time it is.
It's technically time to be over, but also we started late, so I say we have 2 minutes.
Okay. Does anyone want to ask a question or anything?
Who's your favorite Link?
Oh, I think my favorite is definitely the Tears of the Kingdom Link. He just has he has personality, even though he doesn't talk. But there's answers he can give people where he's a real smartass. Where like you go into the bar. For the Garuda bar, and they're like, wait a minute, how old are you? And you can answer, I'm actually 100. And and they get pissed off if you say that. But what's your
follow-up question?
Of course.
What is your, like, when you're going into a cutscene, like, your uniform that you wear? Like,
yeah.
Is the Zodai armor, like, chest plate and leggings, but then the Dinral headset? I don't know why. I just, it's giving draconian vibes, and I'm all about it.
I had a talk about on some panel or podcast about how I really love what they do with the glam, and you can tell I'm a Final Fantasy 14 player, I can just say glam, what they do with the glam in that game. And I love the barbarian armor. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember what I was wearing by the end, and it looked so cool. Like, I think the Royal Guard armor was amazing, but generally I default to the barbarian armor. It has a good stat bonus as well as I remember. So, yeah. He looks good in anything. Just make him naked. Can't go wrong.
I had developed a pattern myself where I was wearing the depths armor, but only the boots and the shirt, because I felt the top was just too much of a KKK hood.
Yeah, so I saw that. Yeah, I'm not wearing that shirt.
Yeah.
Seems bad.
I took that one off. So instead, I used the Phantom Helmet in most cases, and I generally left that on in a lot of cutscenes. So you'll have a character with a face and emoting, and it's just facing this giant blank red eyes, and I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, I think the game gives you a lot of options for masks, and some of them, like, you can wear, like, the Link to the Past, Link's Awakening, the new Link, the kind of, like, really doll-faced Link, and just, that's really weird in cutscenes, and especially serious ones, like, oh, I'm going to die, and then he's just sitting there, like, with a weird-ass, like, Koopy doll look on his face.
Yeah, I also, late in the game, I upgraded... Yeah. Late in the game, I upgraded and wore the entire Fierce Deity set, which the only funny thing about that was because the cap has physics.
Yeah.
So if you're in somewhere that's very windy, which that game has a lot of wind, it shoots straight up. So you've got like a whole Keebler Elf thing going on, which I thought was hilarious.
It looks like the gnome from that meme, like
right.
The low-res gnome. It's really creepy. Any other questions? Don't be shy. Well, if not, thank you all so very much for coming. I hope you enjoyed the panel. And hopefully see you next year.
Can I plug myself?
No, go ahead.
Okay. My name is Diamond Fight. You can find me around the internet by looking for Fight Club. F-E-I-T, that's my last name. C-L-U-B is one of the many weapons you can find in Tears of the Kingdom.
And you, Mr. Parrish.
Oh, you can't find me, don't bother looking.